Welcome to How to Stop Climate Change. I'm your host, David Butler, and I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Russell, and my producer and daughter, Keaton Butler.
Our guest today is Shuli Goodman, founder and executive director of LF Energy, a new Linux Foundation project that supports open source innovation in the energy and electricity sectors.
It's great to have you here, Shuli, and we're excited to hear about kind of your career and how you got to where you are. So what started you down this path?
Well, I guess it's like 14 years ago now. I was kind of in the middle of my career in enterprise information management. I worked for Deloitte Consulting. So I was working with the largest companies in the world. And I had this moment of reflection in which I had an imaginary conversation with my as yet unborn grandchildren. And in the conversation, they said to me, "What did you do during the Great Transition?" So think ahead 20 years or 30 years. Imagine what it will look like from that generation looking backwards. I thought that the notion of this being the Great Transition is a tremendously important way to frame what we're going through. So my response was, the idea of saying nothing, but I was worried, felt intolerable to me. And, you know, not always did I know exactly why I was doing something, but I began a process. And I went and I did 2 years part-time in an MBA program, a green MBA program, and decided that I'd been managing MBAs for years and that I didn't think an MBA was going to help me. So I decided to go get a PhD, and that was an incredible journey. But as anyone who's ever done a PhD knows, it's like a journey of 10,000 books. It's steep, it's alone, and you keep figuring out how to keep standing on top of the shoulders of those that came before you. So my dissertation topic I started with the question from William Gibson, who's a futurist, and he wrote, "The future is here, it's just unevenly distributed." And I thought that that was so brilliant and so right on, because if you've ever traveled, you can see places where people are truly living into the future and other places where people are much more wed to the past. So I began on my PhD journey because really I felt like I couldn't look my grandchildren in the eyes and say I was concerned, I was worried, but I was really just caught up in the mundaneness of my life. And I now have a 3.5-year-old grandson, and I have another grandson coming in August. So from where I sit, I at least feel like I'll be able to look at them in 20 years from now and for them to know that I was just as concerned about the future as they are.
Yeah. Yeah. So Shuli, I actually read your abstract for your PhD thesis, and there was a phrase in there that caught my attention, transformational phenomenology. So tell me, what is that? That sounds pretty cool.
Just a heads up, Shuli had to switch from her computer to her phone for the rest of the interview, so it sounds a little different.
When you're in the process of doing a dissertation, there's the question that you want to explore, and then there's the process for how you did it. I made a decision that I actually wanted it to be very personal. I wanted to not only include my own story of transformation, but I also wanted to be able to look at communities that had experienced extreme climate events. I interviewed 3 different communities that had events, Parkersburg, Iowa, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and Greensburg, Kansas. Mm-hmm. And all of them had either floods or tornadoes, really like horrific tornadoes that had destroyed the communities. So The process that I used was actually the hero's journey. It's something that Joseph Campbell pointed out. And it's about the common framework and narrative that all mythology has with regards to how humans step into their potential and really take up the cause of their own lives. I believe that that is exactly the place that we need to be right now. When I got to the end of the dissertation, there were a couple of things that became really clear to me about spending 4 years focusing on why are we not changing? We see climate collapse coming along, but why aren't we changing? You know, one of them is what Gandhi said about be the change you want to see. And in the end, that's really the only choice that we have, is to make a commitment to embodying the change that we want to see. The second thing is related to the conditions around which the future emerges, meaning the future is not determined, it is not predestined. There is really no fate other than the fate of repetition of particular things and actions and words that lead us down a certain path. And if you want to create a different future, you have to tend to the conditions out of which that future emerges. And I believe that if you really understand how to grow something and you live in relationship to the natural cycles, you understand that for the future to emerge in the ways that we want, we have to tend to those conditions in ways that enable it, which is, I think, a pretty simple way of thinking about the future, often that escapes us because of our lack of understanding about the natural world around us.
You raise a number of fantastic points there, but one that you spoke about, the future is now, and how we have to have that understanding of our environment to be able to step away from past mistakes and form a new type of behavior. But I worry, and I'm hoping you can correct me here, that that isn't actually happening, because although we do see these trends happening, particularly in the US and in Europe now, but there are Pacific Islanders, for example, who are aware of climate change to the extent that they have relocation plans drawn up for whole communities, possibly to the extent of abandoning whole islands in search of new areas to live. And these aren't just idle thoughts or speculations that some communities have in these islands. These are government policies for these islands that they've put in as part of a disaster mitigation plan. So that really hard future is with us now. Do you think that messaging coming perhaps from some of the more susceptible communities on Earth is getting across, and we are adjusting quickly enough to where we are, where the future is now, so to speak?
You know, that's such a great example. So going back to my first statement about how the future is here, it's just unevenly distributed. You have Pacific Islanders who are facing oceans rising and recognizing that their entire way of life is going to be disrupted. It really becomes the obligation of all of us to understand how to tell those stories and to make sure that those stories get told. So when I look at how the future emerges and it being unevenly distributed, it's really important that those feedback systems get created so that that narrative and that story begins to influence how people see things. And in this way, you know, change is not linear. It's much more complex and interactive than a binary kind of thing, like this happens and then that happens. That may be exactly how something unfolds, but you can see it in COVID. If you were going to think of a loser in COVID, our cities. It makes no sense to be living in such dense urban environments, so far removed from nature and from being able to have water, electricity, things that we need, and food. And so I see that we are in a moment and time of great dislocation. We are at the absolute very beginning, unfortunately. And I look at this, and there are two different metaphors that I've had. And one is, I didn't know this, but when you have a flock of swans, the name for it is a ballet. And I think that that's a really beautiful metaphor, that we are in the middle of a ballet of black swans. And we need to anticipate that there's not going to be just one shoe dropping, but there are going to be 100 shoes dropping, because we have systems in collapse, and we have multiple systems in collapse. And because of that, there are going to be really both virtuous and vicious cycles that are going to, you know, come into creation around that, because you have systems that, you know, that are going to dissipate, and they're going to go future seeking. So when I think about what I do in the world, it's that I want to be in that place so that when systems go looking for the future, they will begin to see the opportunity and the potential, in this case of LF Energy, with regards to transforming the grid.
That is a fantastic metaphor, a ballet of black swans. And it's very visual, but it's important to remember that a black swan is more like a dragon. You know, it's not necessarily a good thing. So it's kind of an apocalyptic vision in a way. You know, black swans are just something completely unexpected, right?
True, but, you know, I think, at least I've lived long enough to recognize that sometimes we look at something and we think, oh, this is absolutely horrible. And then we realize, oh, my God, you know, this was one of the best things that ever happened to us. And, you know, the complexity of holding all those things is really what a mature human adult looks like. You know, you can live through an absolutely horrific thing and come out the other side and be more awake and more enlightened and not just completely destroyed by an event.
That's a good point.
You know, and that happens because we are willing to learn from what is happening around us and to recognize that everything that we're doing is an experiment. You know, that's part of what's so tragic about what's going on in the United States, is that the democracies are fragile. You can destroy them. In the much the same way if you had a marriage with someone. I mean, what is a marriage? It is a contract between two people that they're going to, you know, love and cherish each other. And in the same way, what is a democracy? It is a contract. And if you destroy that social contract, you should not be surprised if people, you know, rise up and protest. And sometimes those protests will be, you know, immense expressions of, you know, violence and hatred and anger. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that we're facing. And the only, you know, reasonable way to meet them is with compassion and with recognition that all of us hold some part of that narrative. All of us have our own stories. And it's incumbent that we all own our stories. I think that one of the most, the greatest poetic expressions of conversation about the future, there's two things that I would say about it. One is Rilke, and it is the letter number 8 in the Letters to a Poet. You know, in it, he says, you know, most of us walk around thinking that we're completely surprised when the future happens to us. But the truth is that the future always lives within us. And in the same way, when I look at climate collapse, this is not a surprise. We have a grid, an electrical system, that had externalities. And we had a belief that it was okay to operate with 60% loss of electrons. So, you know, in a typical coal fire plant or energy generation system, energy gets generated and then it gets transported in the process from generation to when you flip a switch. About 60% of the electrons are lost. Well, that's kind of unbelievable. When you think about it from a design perspective, the only people who benefit from 60% electron loss are the people who are providing the fuel. You know, there is no other benefit. And so I think it becomes incumbent upon all of us to really imagine from a place of innovation, if every hour, we have enough sun hitting the Earth to power the Earth for a year, we have an opportunity to figure out how to collect that and to provide energy. You know, it opens up fundamentally new doorways. And so when I think about energy and power, I think that we have to transform energy and power, not only at the grid, but we have to transform it in societies. And as we do that, the mind that imagines and conceives of energy will transform. When I'm talking with the engineers and the enterprise architects that I work with all day, every day, it is really getting them to think from a multidisciplinary perspective, to think like an artist, to think like a designer, to think like a scientist, to be able to manage all of those things at once. I believe that we will be able to create innovations that we haven't even imagined. And when we look back 30 years from now, we'll really think, wow, our society was quite primitive, and the technologies we were using to provide energy and power were equally primitive. And, you know, we have two choices. Either we transform and become that, or we deteriorate into some kind of, agonizingly selfish and thoughtless global community.
There certainly are examples of agonizing selfishness and thoughtlessness. And, you know, you talk about how the future is not evenly distributed, and certainly thinking about the future, being aware of the future is not evenly distributed. You know, a lot of people go about their day-to-day life and they're thinking about today or the next day and how they're going to put food on the table. And then you think about the fossil fuel companies that knew what was happening in the 70s and 80s and yet chose to make sure that nobody else knew that that was happening.
Absolutely. It is agonizingly selfish.
You mentioned a little while ago about working with the grid and the engineers in it and the losses associated with the grid as it stands at the moment, which seems to dovetail nicely with what you're saying about not contradicting fundamental laws. Like, energy is there, it's going to be lost unless you make an effort to conserve it. And you have to, and you are working with engineers, trying to work with them creatively and imaginatively to future-proof these technologies as best we can now. But can you give us a little bit of a sense of how you made that journey from finishing your dissertation into getting into a role now where you're trying to give that level of leadership to make the changes in these industries?
Sure. So bottom line, what my PhD was about innovation. And I particularly focused on the adoption and diffusion of innovation. So I went out into the world, and I was working on a project for the state of California about time of use rates. And during that time, I interviewed the three independently owned utilities, their IT departments. Because of my background in IT, I was pretty well suited to do that. I had these interviews and I had an absolute like, oh, we are in unbelievable trouble. If this is the best we have on the planet, you know, California, in terms of the greening of, you know, the grid, we are in unbelievable trouble because these guys do not have the technology or the capacity to meet the future that's going to come running at us. The other thing was a sense of alarm about how our governance is with regulators and the utilities commissions. Being a PhD, I went and I did research. I wanted to try and find out, are there any models for governance that actually move at the speed of technology and could, in fact, provide the kind of input that is required to create good policy that guides and governs regulated entities. And what I found was that this was woefully researched. I actually could not find any current research that was done on governance models for regulatory commissions globally. And if there anybody out there doing PhD work or considering to do a thesis, I really encourage that, because governance and how society contributes to the regulatory environment for a utility is really important, because the utility needs to be in relationship to the social contract. So I started looking at that, and the thing that came up for me in that research was the Linux Foundation. And it wasn't that I hadn't heard of the Linux kernel or the Linux operating system, but I didn't really know that there was a foundation. And so I started doing research, and then I started sending them emails and saying, you know, I really want to talk with you about your governance model, because I was thinking to myself, why don't we use that kind of governance model for all manner of transformative initiatives? Like, this sounds amazing, you know, and you have this diffusion phenomena where you had a guy in a dorm room in Helsinki, Linus Torvald, hacked a Unix operating system so that he could do what he wanted to do without buying a Sun workstation or, you know, feeding Microsoft, who was at that point, you know, a lot of developers felt they were evil. And I just want to make a call out that Microsoft has made a 180-degree turn on open source.
Just to give you a little background, Torvalds developed an operating system just like Windows, iOS, and macOS called Linux. In fact, one of the most popular platforms on the planet, Android, is powered by the Linux operating system. To put it simply, the operating system manages the communication between your software and your hardware on your computer or phone. Without the operating system, the software wouldn't function. Linux is the operating system for over 95% of the top 1 million domains. More than 80% of new smartphones sold run Android, which is based on the Linux kernel, and it's the infrastructure supporting the world's e-commerce leaders, including Amazon, eBay, PayPal, and Walmart. All this because in early 1991, unhappy with the available operating systems, Torvalds wanted to buy a Unix system. Luckily for us, he didn't have enough money, so he decided to make his own clone of Unix from scratch. This led to Linux.
What I realized about the Linux Foundation and about the Linux kernel is that you had a situation where something got brought into the world, and there were no guns, nobody was killed, there were no standing armies, there were no politicians, and there were no incredibly complicated and convoluted governance procedures. Yet you had something that went from a dorm room and in 20, 25, 30 years became the absolute platform and foundation, pretty much, for the entire digital world. And everything, even, you know, our Zoom conversation, our email, all of that is based on open source. And so the Linux Foundation, you know, the kernel was put into the Linux Foundation as a way of protecting a kind of succession after, you know, Linus, at some point, maybe he'll retire, to create governance so that corporations could jointly invest in this software without fear of losing their intellectual property. So at its foundation, what the Linux Foundation does is it is a legal structure that enables collective and joint investment. And when I first came, I think there were 140 projects. Now there are 250. You have that same sort of mechanism of protecting the intellectual property, dividing and separating kind of business functioning from technology functioning. And, you know, there are a number of different foundations that are dedicated to open source. They do a great job. However, at this point, the Linux Foundation is kind of the largest of them. And while no institution is perfect, my experience has been, I finally got a meeting. I walked in. I said, I'm looking for Switzerland, you know, kind of joking. It was in December of 2016, right after Trump had been elected. And I could see that we were heading for an utter disaster. And it is far worse than I ever could have imagined. But what I wanted was a place where we could collaborate together where you had an institution that had the historical memory and the DNA to enable and facilitate cooperation and collaboration to build the digital foundations of the grid of the future. Because that software doesn't really exist. There are parts of it that exist, but there is work that needs to be done. You know, so whether it's CNCF is the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, and that is about distributed computing, and distributed computing and distributed energy are essential to each other. In the same way that LF networking is building out the platforms that drive 5G, and 70% of all mobile traffic runs over open source, that is also going to be incredibly important to the grid of the future. It is going to be the communication ability to manage latency, to be able to manage milliseconds, because when you're talking about electricity, you're talking about time sequences that go from milliseconds to minutes, and that each of them require different sorts of communication tools. So I think we all thought it was going to be much quicker, but as we know, inertia is a guiding principle of the grid, and it exists in the organizations as well as, you know, in sort of the supply and demand equations. And that's how I got to the Linux Foundation, and I do think it is one of the absolutely coolest things on the planet, and cannot speak highly enough of it as an organization. It's truly an honor to have LF Energy live inside of the Linux Foundation.
That's fantastic, and it makes me optimistic when you think about all the things that have spread from Linux that you just described. And we really need that same thing to happen with the grid.
I agree. So outside my window, I have an orchard. I realized that I would never go outside and start yelling and screaming at my apple and pear trees to give me fruit in February. I understand that there are seasons and that those seasons have to be respected. I've really had to learn that with LF Energy as well, because I would have wanted this to go much faster. And in fact, I think it's gone fine in terms of time. And so I have no complaints, but it has not been at the time scale that I thought it should be. But now I recognize that for LF Energy to really legitimately become the center of gravity for the digital foundations of the grid of the future, there's a lot we have to do. It's kind of like you have to create the conditions for that to happen. And part of it is about capacity, competency. It's about telling a story. It's about engaging people. It's about getting people to understand what digitalization means, really legitimately, be able to sort the difference between science projects and ideas and reality, and recognizing that there's some things we want to do today and you can see the glimmers of it, but you know, they may take 5, 10, 15 years to happen because there are technology evolutions that we need to put into place in order to make them real. And right now, my big issue is really helping grid operators, network operators, whether they're at high, medium, or low voltage, manage the data that is going to start, you know, flowing in enormous quantities at them. And right now they don't have that ability. And so, you know, on some level, yes, utilities are not picking it up as quickly as we would like them to. But part of it is that they don't have the capacity to. And they actually don't have the infrastructure to. So we have a project we're launching today called Compass. And it's part of a larger digital substation automation project. And this particular project, Compass, is about configuration. And it's using 61850 to configure the substation bus in order to be able to enable a much more rapid flow of data from the edge, which will allow network operators, grid operators, to orchestrate and choreograph intermittent energy. And so So I am extremely bullish about this. GE is part of the project. They're joining as members of LF Energy. Schneider Electric, National Grid, RTE, Alliander, Tenet, all of these players all working together to build this together. And so if I were to say the difference between the LF Energy Foundation and the Cloud Native Computing Foundation is rather than having somebody come and give a big body of code to LF Energy, I mean, we do get code, but the grid is so big, what LF Energy really has the ability to do and what I am growing it to do is to be able to be a leveraged development model where people can work together to build the components and parts of the grid of the future.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Hey, I just want to take a second to say thanks to Tim Mina. Tim is our very first Patreon donor, and that really means a lot. It gives us the encouragement to keep forging ahead with the podcast and to work hard to make better and better episodes. So thanks so much, Tim. We really appreciate that.
To learn how to support the show, go to howtostopclimatechange.com/support or patreon.com/howtostopclimatechange.
Can you talk through some of the shortcomings with our current grid and, you know, how we can overcome those?
First of all, the grid in the United States is different than the grid in Europe. You know, there have been a number of articles recently in the U.S. press about how U.S. exceptionalism is being challenged. I think that the U.S. absolutely has a big problem with our grid because, like our roads, we have not invested in them. And you can see the fires in California. You know, it's not that those fires don't happen in the south of France, but they do not happen to the extent that they happen in the U.S. or with such tragic outcomes. And the reason why has been because of the investment. So the U.S. created a regulatory environment where you have investor-owned utilities or municipalities, and they're slightly different business models in terms of how we invest in the grid. So when you talk about the problems of the grid, a lot of the problems of the grid in the U.S. are that it's aging infrastructure that needs to be invested in. You know, like the transformer that blew up that caused the fires 2 years ago, I think was a, 50, 60, 70-year-old transformer.
Over 1,500 California fires in the past 6 years, including the deadliest ever, were caused by one company, PG&E. A problem with PG&E equipment caused the Camp Fire in 2018, which killed at least 85 people and razed more than 18,800 structures. It is currently the deadliest and most destructive fire in California history.
And so we have aging infrastructure, and so that's a problem in the U.S. The problems in Europe are really not so much with the infrastructure. It's that a lot of the effort right now is being put on network codes and interoperability, data models, things that are going to enable interoperability. So at a kind of systemic level, this issue of interoperability, you know, you have vendors like Siemens that would say, France, if you want all of these things to play together, just buy all of our products. I think that everybody is beginning to understand that's not going to happen, that we need to have interoperability, and that there are going to be parts of the grid, particularly the digitalization parts, that need to be based on, you know, x86 commodity hardware. In order to get to where we need to go, we have to decrease the cost of what we're doing at such an accelerated and rapid rate. I think that you can see from a case history standpoint, for instance, that kind of evolution of cost shifting in telecommunications. So 30 years ago, you might have had a cell phone, but it would have been the size of a suitcase and it would have cost you, you know, $10,000 or $20,000. Today, you can have, you know, unbelievable computing power in a couple hundred dollar device. So it's a really different model, but it has enabled the digitalization of telecommunications has enabled a rapid acceleration of new products and services that, you know, has kept the world humming, even during a complete radical, like, 180-degree shift in working in big centers to working at home. So that has been available because of open source and because of radical cost shifting with regards to telecommunications. We need to do the same thing with energy. And as solar and wind come down in cost, we have to be able to onboard those resources and be able to manage demand response between homes, buildings, commercial and industrial, and the grid. And so it's a lot of complex choreography, orchestration, and that's the direction that we're going in. And so I would say we have a human problem that we do not necessarily have. In the U.S., we have an incredibly aging group of executives and employees, over 50, over 60, getting ready to retire. I am not saying that they cannot be, as I am, a change agent, but many of them are not digitally native. And so they don't necessarily understand, this is what we're going to have to do to our grid. This is how we're going to transform it. So we have a resource issue. We have to teach people, how to actually design the grid of the future and to be, become technology companies and begin hiring, as many digital folks as possible. So that's that, and then there's the aging situation. And then in the U.S., there's also regulatory problems where we have regulators who just fundamentally do not understand digital. And so, the resources in California, for instance, are all being managed on a spreadsheet. And I'm kind of like, are you kidding me? But that's,
wow.
That's the
truth.
That's
horrible.
Right. The PUC is managing things in a spreadsheet. It's a complex spreadsheet. It requires a lot of sophistication to manage it, but it really is an absolute failure that our regulatory environment is as conservative as it is in a time when we need to be moving at the pace of technology.
I think that technological shift you've mentioned is common across all of the technological discipline. So we see it in science and medical ethics and places like that too. We have a real difficulty as a culture, and particularly the legal framework for those cultures, adapting to something that's moving around us as quickly as it is. So I can really empathize with some of the challenges you're facing there. But it is equally remarkable that you've got these big blue chip companies collaborating in an open source framework and have been able to do it in a way that they're still protecting revenue streams and we have a plan for the future. So taking all of the challenges you've mentioned, I would still be hugely optimistic with what you're trying to accomplish. One of the questions I would ask is, on the front end, what are consumers going to see with this grid of the future? Will we even notice a change? Is it going to be a cost reduction? Is there an obligation on us to engage with it? How will that affect us as users?
Well, so, like you, food and agriculture is really important to me. And in Europe and the U.S., there's some similarities around farm to table, that there's this recognition of, grow local, eat local, buy local. The same thing is true with energy. The closer your energy is to your home, the less loss you're going to have. Now, not everybody in the world can go out by any stretch of the imagination and put in solar and batteries and all of that. But I do think that communities and community choice aggregation, which is happening here in California, and energy communities, which are happening in Europe, I absolutely think that they're on the forefront of where we're going, which is that this kind of utility or common good needs to be located as close to people as possible. And in that way, the governance of them becomes, you know, much easier because it's not, you know, we're not dealing with FERC. We're not dealing with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that's so far away, or, you know, the Energy Division in the European Commission. So in that way, my guess is we're going to keep moving in that direction. And because the U.S. is, you know, really hitting the wall, because we're having system collapse on so many levels, I don't know that that's a bad thing, that our energy, our consumption, our food, our communities really need to be invigorated and become, you know, the center of our civic engagement. So I see that as positive, and I see that as inevitable. But there is the rest of the world. And what I'd like to imagine is that there are going to be leapfrogs that are going to happen. You know, there are over a billion people pretty much on the planet who have no electricity at all. And I think symbolically, they have no energy, they have no power. So if all of your energy is spent every day moving gallons of water from 2 miles away so that you can have something to drink and you can have some food, you know, you're going to stay in poverty forever. And particularly when there are such low-cost solutions to that, that could move the water quite easily. So, you know, like COVID, you can't have an isolated solution to it. You have to have a collective solution to it. And so, you know, when I think out into the future, and when I think about sort of, you know, how LF Energy and, you know, the sort of the digital parts can really accelerate the transformation, it's really also about leapfrogging technologies so that these things can end up in developing worlds, because, you know, we think immigration is an issue right now in the U.S. We're at the very beginning of this massive dislocation of people who are going to be wandering around because, and, you know, desperate because they are thirsty and they are hungry and they are scared. It's not like they're thinking to themselves, oh, I really want to leave. I want to leave my home. I want to leave my community. I want to leave my family. They're doing it because they have to, and because it's not safe. And so it becomes our obligation not to build walls, but to build opportunity. And part of that opportunity is directly connected to electricity. And it's directly giving people access to energy and to power. And, you know, the difference for me about energy and power are that, you know, power is kind of the volume of energy that you have. And, you know, energy can create lights, but, you know, it's going to be power that's going to create, you know, really vast economic transformation.
You know, when you think about power, and it's not just electrical power or heat power, there's also human power, political power, economic power. And if everything is centralized, if, you know, if electrical power is centralized, then you also get centralized political power and economic power. And I think that's the amazing thing about distributed generation. You know, you have decentralized power and decentralized political and economic power as well. Yeah, I just want to mention that this concept that I just talked about with centralized power generation being tied to centralized political and economic power, and how distributed energy is more democratic and decentralized, I didn't come up with that. I heard that first from my good friend Chris Woolery, who works at the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, and that's MACED, MACED.org. So thanks, Chris.
Do you all know Buckminster Fuller did some really interesting models around energy, and he had this vision of how to electrify the whole planet, because he believed, and I agree with him, that there is a correlation between access to energy, easy access to energy, and the eradication of poverty. So when I think about, you know, my first goal is around climate collapse, but my second goal really is the eradication of abject poverty. It is a moral sin that we have allowed it to exist the way we have. And I believe that energy is the, you know, it's the through line. Energy and power is the through line. And the more centralized energy and power are, the less democratized it is. The more democratized energy is, the more democratized societies are. And I think that there are examples all through history. I look at the Civil War as the U.S.'s first energy crisis, because it became morally reprehensible to be using the energy of humans in the ways that the South was using energy. And that, as you know, trains and electricity and societies changed, it became reprehensible. And the fact that the vestiges of that continue to live in the United States, and the United States is being such a slow mover with regards to climate collapse, they're all connected. But I fundamentally believe the more distributed energy is, the more democratized societies become.
For you, speaking to our listeners and the change you've gone through, or what you embraced, having thought about your grandchildren and what you'd like to be able to say to them when the opportunity arrives, as they look back on this transformative change time frame we're in at the moment, what would you say to our listeners as to what they can do? Or is there something from your own past that's resonated with you so much that you went, this is it, I have to do something now, or I'll never forgive myself?
So we live in the age of COVID, and I think that all of us have experienced an enormous amount of discomfort. Some of us really a lot, some of us it's just been inconvenient, but it's uncomfortable. And unfortunately, I believe that if we don't do something, all of us, we will look back on this as being a good time. And that's a frightening thing. I believe that one of the most interesting and ironic paradoxes of COVID is that everybody is being told to go outside. So go outside, go find natural environment, go sit next to a tree and have a conversation with it for a month, every single day for an hour. We need to learn from the natural world that we live in, because we are living in a world that is pushing up against, you know, the limits, and because we have lost our way with regards to nature. But I think that it really gets back to, what I was saying about the hero's journey. Every single human that is born onto this earth is born with kind of their own unique genius, and that is the star that we are all born under. Each of us has that. And you have to go out and find it and get to know yourself and get closer to yourself so that you understand that the choices you make right now are going to be absolutely pivotal in creating the world that we want to live in. For instance, how do you use wood? Do you just invariably go out and go, oh, I want a bigger house. I want more of this. I want more stuff. I mean, maybe it's the end of stuff. You know, maybe we need to stop thinking about stuff. Maybe the things that we need to be thinking about are the things that you can grow with seeds. And we put our energy into growing food, into community gardens, and into, you know, creating childcare environments that, you know, are really raise up the next generation. I think that there's a role for everyone. And some of it may seem outsized and mythical, and some is that you are part of something that's bigger than yourself, and that you love that. But if we don't all find ways to love ourselves, and I don't mean in the selfish sense, but in the sense where we are at one with ourselves, it is going to be really hard to be at one with each other. And so fundamentally, the path to transformation starts with ourselves.
A key part of the hero's journey is overcoming obstacles. You hit the valley of despair, you raise out of it. And that's why we root for the heroes. We empathize with them. We see their journey, their transition, the development of their strength and self-empowerment. This is a time full of those sort of challenges. There's ample opportunity for anybody to be able to reach out and grab one and try and grow alongside it.
I really agree. And find the stories that teach you how to be a human, because that is what's needed. And the through line runs through nature. I mean, you know, David White speaks, you know, brilliantly about the relationship of humans to nature. And, you know, and in that way, we all have to become poets. We all have to find that story and that poetry. And, you know, yeah, they're technical parts, and some of us have brains that understand, you know, technical things. But, you know, most of us, what we really actually can do best is love and be kind. And if we just started with that, it would make a really huge difference, so that we can really change our social structures. You know, in the age of like Black Lives Matter, you know, what it's really about is, you know, an unequal distribution of health. And in the 20th century, we focused on, you know, the distribution of wealth, and it became kind of this, you know, epic narrative. But what won actually really disregarded is there an equitable distribution of health? And I think that climate collapse is really a health crisis, and we have to make that be our North Star. Is there an equitable distribution of health? And what are the things that we need to be healthy? In the same way that if you go plant a garden, you have to tend to those plants, and you can tell whether they're healthy or not, whether they're productive. And if we have huge parts of our societies and our worlds that are not productive, it's because we're not tending to the garden.
Well, thanks so much, Shuli. That was a fantastic conversation.
It really, really has been a pleasure.
I think it's kind of amazing to be sitting someplace with really bad internet and still be able to affect the world.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of How to Stop Climate Change, please give us a review or share the show with a friend. If you'd like to support the show, please head over to howtostopclimatechange.com/support. All donations will go to cover expenses and help me pay my daughter, Keaton, for all the time she spends editing and producing the show.
For more information about what the Linux Foundation is doing to fight climate change, visit lfenergy.org. That's lfenergy.org. If you would like to reach out to Shuli directly, her email is sgoodman@lfenergy.org. You can also find that on the contact page of their website. Music for this episode was done by Avery Reedy and myself, Keaton Butler. Our theme music is by Juices.